Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and you're listening to DNA. Do you love to get lost in a labyrinth? Well, if so, there's no need to make a trip to a medieval cathedral or an aristocrat's estate. It turns out there's many a labyrinth in Los Angeles.
It's a black ink tattoo on my left foot. It's of a classical labyrinth, which is the same as the one we're sitting next to. So there's just a tinier version of what we're sitting in front of.
The thing I like most about Sarah's labyrinth tattoo? It's open to the public by appointment.
Gideon Brower reports from LA's labyrinths, and he explains why they are not mazes. And coming up in a moment, many Angelenos have ripped out their lawns to save water, but we've also heard that might kill our trees. How can we reconcile drought and our created Eden? But first, walk east on Wilshire from Lacombe on the south side of the street and you'll find yourself at CAFAM, that is the Craft and Folk Art Museum. There in the window you might see a man with a dark shag haircut bent over old tools and machines making shoes. He's called Chris Francis and he has an exhibition and a pop-up workshop at the museum. But these aren't just any shoes. Chris is the glam-rockingest shoemaker you're ever likely to meet. He makes custom footwear for stage performers who, like him, believe music and over-the-top shoes are essential to life.
It's a little frustrating now. I see bands perform on stage and it's almost like they're performing in flip-flops and blue jeans. And where's the visual presentation? Where's the stage show?
Before he became a shoemaker, Chris was a carpenter who'd spent several years riding freight trains around the country. Now he's an artist maker with 35 pairs of shoes on exhibit, some insanely long, others crazy high, made of wild colours and salvaged materials. The curator is Holly Jerger.
Really, what we're interested in is showing people who make things by hand and have a very distinctive vision to what they're producing. And when we met Chris, we were really blown away by the shoes he had been producing. He was talking a lot about the various influences that filter into his shoes, which we were also very interested in, that there is a story there.
The inspiration comes from classic shoes, but also music, architecture, literature. I walk around with Chris and he points out, for example, a bizarre-looking heel that he says draws from the experiments of an 18th-century engineer. He shows me sky-high wedges made of patches of Indian fabric with pink pom-poms that reflect his fantasies about travel. And then we stop at a pair of stilettos with liberty spikes made of broom bristles and sides with patches of ripped fabric and a Sex Pistols button.
The patches on the shoes are from my pants when I was riding freight trains, and they're all sewn on with dental floss. That's what I used to sew with when I was on the train. And then there's pieces of the walls of CBGBs sewn onto the shoe and glued onto canvas. The pistols button came off of my uncle's jacket. He gave it to me when I was a kid. I think it actually went to one of the shows. What I gravitate towards in the shoe, a lot of these are about machines and factories, like the factories I grew up beside when I was a kid. So when I'm sitting there in the shoe shop making or designing, I'm trying to get to that point to where I was at as a kid with all these very hard, stark lines in the sky, like smokestacks and hard metal and bold, sort of bland color in some ways. But I love vibrant color, so I'm trying to mix that. And also a lot of these are about sound.
In what sense?
It's just visual interpretation of music. For me, like if I listen to music, and it's hard to explain, but you know, I can sort of associate certain colors with sounds and shapes and forms.
There's so definitely a performance quality to these shoes. I feel like this could be Bowie or T-Rex or Queen, you know, are those in any way your inspirations?
Oh, absolutely. Queen is in a lot of these shoes. Because I'm fascinated with the sound of Queen. It's very deep and rich. And I always sort of feel like if I could, or the goal, and I don't know if I've ever achieved it, is sort of capture like how I feel like the levels of sound are in Queen, try to capture that in a shoe. But I mean, this is an impossible thing. I don't know that it can ever be done, but I think about things like that when I'm making shoes.
You said you grew up in a factory town. Where did you grow up?
Kokomo, Indiana. We had steel mills and auto factories and sort of a lot of factories. All different types of things were made there at one point in time. It was definitely not glamorous where I was from. I mean, we scrubbed the soot off the houses in the 80s. So things were a little drab. But that's sort of what I love, though, now and what I miss. And if there's a way to make that wearable, I want to try to do it. It formed me where I'm from. And it's sort of in the way I walk or talk or anything about me, the way I hold my wine glass is sort of shaped by just my upbringing, I guess.
How do you hold your wine glass?
Sort of like it's a can of beer. A little rough around the edges, I guess. I can't hide it.
So, basic question, how did you become a shoe designer?
I was at a party at Louis Vuitton, and they had flown a shoemaker in from France, and that was the first time I'd seen a shoe being made by hand in front of me. I was fascinated by it. I stayed right by him all night and watched him. I probably annoyed him. And the next day, I was hard at work trying to figure out the mysteries of the shoe. I had a boot made by the end of the week, and it was, you know, horribly wrong, but it was wearable. And then I just didn't stop. I just kept going and going and going, making more shoes. Most of them all in the beginning, I mean, they were just complete failures, structural failures. You know, it's like building bridges, and they just, because I wanted to build high heels because I wanted to manipulate form and try to make wearable structures, kind of how I was building houses or building them, you know, different places around town.
And then you set about learning some of the traditional skills of the shoemaker. Mm-hmm. And did you learn from local shoemakers?
That was very difficult. I couldn't get an internship. A, I couldn't afford an internship. And B, they just really weren't offered. It's a bit secretive. I mean, people hold their secrets to the shoe. They don't want to just hand someone the keys to the kingdom on how to make a shoe. And I completely understand that. I did learn from going shop to shop, looking for tools, any kind of loose tool I could find to make a shoe, because they don't really make the tools anymore. I would ask a shoemaker if they had a certain tool, and then they would all have time to give me one tip on how to make a shoe. But no one would have time to sit me down and do an internship. So I guess I learned from every shoemaker in town how to make a shoe.
Do we have a lot of shoemakers in town? No. And where are they?
Most of them are repairmen now. But some of the old repairmen were shoemakers. But once shoes started being made overseas, it's so hard to be a shoemaker now.
As in custom shoemaker. This is what we're talking about.
Yeah, a custom shoemaker.
Would you give someone an internship to come and work with you?
Yes, yeah. And then it would be easier for me. So then I could keep on making designs. I guess making doesn't always entertain me anymore. I get bored on the second shoe sometimes.
Oh, so you'll make the right, but then the left is kind of annoying.
I'm already on the next set of ideas. So I'm planning on the next pair. So it's becoming more about design rather than making.
Can you say, in words, why you're so fixated on shoes?
I don't know, but it's been a long fixation.
But it's the shape of the shoe. It's not the wearing of the shoe and the being in the shoe.
No, I like to see them on shelves.
Chris Francis is an LA-based shoe designer and maker. He's currently working at the Craft and Folk Art Museum, where his shoes are on display in an exhibition through September. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Since the drought entered crisis stage, many of us are asking ourselves, how do we conserve water but not lose the Southern California landscape we love? In an earlier DNA, Boom editor John Christensen reminded us that while we must get real about the drought,
I hope that it doesn't just become a long summer of denial. I hope that out of this, there will also be voices for creative, beautiful solutions.
So we asked you to send in images of your gorgeous drought-tolerant yards. But then we heard from landscape designer Mia Lehrer. Her projects include the Natural History Museum Nature Gardens and Vista Hermosa Park. She reminded us that ripping out lawns has consequences.
What is really dangerous about turning off the water to our lawns is that the trees and shrubs that we have are actually getting that residual water from the lawn. And so we're really not just watering the lawn, we're watering our garden in general. The trees, mature trees especially, have gotten used to going deeper with their in their roots and getting water, you know, residual water, like I said. You know, basically our fauna and all our habitat has adjusted to the California garden. Our city is about gardens, and we are redefining what Los Angeles looks like. So we have to be careful. We have to think about it. We have to talk about it. Because if we are going to end up with gravel and wood chips and five shrubs everywhere, we're going to be in a bad place in the next couple years.
So what are we to do? It's all so complicated. Can we have our ecosystemic cake and eat it too? Well, now we're going to hear from another landscape expert, and he believes not all Southern California trees are created equal. Charles Anderson is a landscape architect who specializes in native plantings, in projects from Los Angeles to Southern Europe.
Well, I think it starts almost in a philosophical level of what the California landscape should look like and where native plants are a part of our city. And I remember in 1984, when I first came out of San Bernardino Mountains down into the valley, I looked up into the mountains and saw all these beautiful plants growing, and then I saw this strip of green right next to the highway. And it actually made me not want to live in California at the time because of the type of landscape that I saw everywhere. Everything here was imported from somewhere else, and it didn't seem authentic to me. So when you get down to it, the number of trees and the kinds of landscapes that have been created over the years, over decades now, are at a point where they're overgrown, they're sick, they need water all the time, or they'll die. And we can't have landscapes like that.
You're saying that a large proportion of the trees that we have planted are in no longer in good health.
Especially in the drought, for example, eucalyptus. If you have eucalyptus trees in your yard or in your lawn, you might think of removing it and replacing it with something more appropriate. And there are lots of beautiful trees that could be here. First of all, our California sycamore. Extraordinary tree when it gets big, if it's allowed to get big. And then there's our oak trees, all very drought tolerant. A lot of people try and say sycamore isn't drought tolerant, but it is. It goes semi-dormant in the summertime. That's what it's supposed to do, because if you notice, we don't get much rain in the summer. So it's adaptable. You can water it or you can choose not to water it. It's not complicated, but it's sort of like learning to cook a little bit. You got to think about it. And I think that leads to what kind of landscape you're going to create.
So say you came down from San Bernardino, but it was 200 years ago. Would you have seen trees?
This place was full of trees. It always has. When the Indians lived here, they lived in forests. They lived on the edges of them. It was an extraordinary landscape, and there's no reason it still can't be.
But there is that argument that California has changed its ecology. When we say native now, do we mean the same thing?
That's a great question, because truly ecology is not a static system, and it's meant to change. And that means introduction of other species, however they get here, by birds or by us or by boat, whatever, however they get here. That's an important part of ecology. So I'm not saying a purist notion of ecology is important. We need to create an urban ecology that's appropriate, that works with our climate and especially with climate change. So I'm not against certain plants from other places being part of our landscape at all, but I'm really against the others being excluded completely. It needs to be more balanced. And in my view, I can think of Seattle. Imagine if the giant trees were all around Seattle. Many of them would be higher than the tallest buildings in Seattle, and you'd be looking out your window into a tree canopy where some animals living. That's the kind of vision that I think makes us feel part of ecology and that we miss in our cities.
You and I are currently talking, we're on the west side presently. There's a lot of tree-lined streets, and different streets will have different trees. In your view, are some of those banks of trees the appropriate tree and some not so?
Absolutely. There are so many trials and errors that we've made as designers. For example, ficus. Imagine what that's done to our streets, let alone the amount of water it needs to get going. But it loves living here. Who can hate the tree? And in the right spot, it's exquisite. So I don't see any reason to exclude it, but it should never be a street tree. And there are other trees that do really well as street trees, and they have to be picked. But it has to be by looking at what they really do and what they really need. Because all the trees, a lot of the trees planted along the streets have irrigation systems. And like so many landscapes in California, irrigation has become a central point And that's not sustainable because it fails. The last thing I want people to do is just go out and buy native plants and throw them all over the landscape without thought to what belongs where. It'd be nice if people knew what to put where and had an idea of what kind of landscape they wanted when they made that choice.
Although, on the other hand, you know, many of us are really not good gardeners. We fail over and over again to get something to grow. The native plants, presumably, we could throw into our yard and they'd grow fairly successfully.
Oh, yeah, that's true. And I have a neighbor up in where I live, which is in South Redondo Beach at the Riviera there, and he doesn't water at all. And he has more wildlife than anybody in the neighborhood. It's spectacular. We see fox because he doesn't water and because the landscape is transitioned to a no water. He just doesn't want to water. And it's quite amazing to see what kind of plants and animals have adapted to that site, have come right to it. So, yeah, I think the other way I would love to see it is if everybody got a whole bunch of plants and just killed everything off, turned off the water, and started planting native plants and see what we got. That, to me, would be the most incredible experiment ever. But that'll never happen because people want to control their gardens. And that's an art form. And we all are landscapers or landscape designers. We all are. We go to Home Depot, we pick a plant, we bring it home. Now we need to bring home plants that are adaptable to the current conditions.
When we've talked in the past, Charles, you've sort of referred to literally talking to the trees or hearing the trees talk to you. People might hear that and think that sounds kind of a little bit kooky, but what do you mean by that? And do you feel yourself to be some sort of tree whisperer?
Boy, yes, I'm nuts. That's no question about it. I think a lot of my philosophy comes from Native Americans where they believe that everything's alive and we're always communicating with one another. We just don't always know what we're saying. And I think some of us think more about what other things are in the world. And I just happen to have a focus on plants. And I really believe that there is a relationship we have that's more than just their food and we're predators. And I think there's just like a dog is a pet. I think we're pets of our own world. And I think I think I do hear them talk. It's not literal words, but it's a sense. And I think we're more complicated than just our conversation.
So simply put, why do trees matter? Why do we need trees apart from they provide shade?
Yeah, I think all of us love at one point in our life have fallen in love with a tree or trees or a grove or a forest. And particularly in our landscapes, a tree that grows over us, shelters us, gives us wildlife to look at, makes a little bit of a mess, but it's reliable as something you can go to and be sheltered by, something you can go to and realize that it's alive. It's not just a structure. It's actually a living thing that we have an affinity with. There are so many books and stories written about the tree, and I've worked with so many designers that said, let's put the tree in the design. And I think it's because we want a sense of something overlooking and shadowing and bigger than we are to make us feel coddled like we were when we were babies. And I think that's what the landscape and particularly trees can do for us.
And so when we see a tree taken down by a hurricane or by human hand, you know, by choice, we feel kind of a gut-wrenching feeling.
Every time something like that leaves our life, it's like losing a friend. And that connection that we have to a tree and plants and all that's within it is in our DNA.
So in LA, because it's, you know, semi-arid, there appears to be a kind of a class system around trees.
Yes, there's always has been a class. The poorer people can't spend the extra money to water a tree, for example, and they don't want to buy a tree that needs water. They have other needs, so they're bypassed, and they don't understand that there are other choices, and they're not given those choices. Simply by making a program where we're giving all the homeowners out there that don't have a lot of money a tree. A native tree, for example, or a tree that's very drought tolerant that they can put in their yard and water once and forget about. We could tree line most of the city that isn't tree filled right now very easily.
So to the contention that people should perhaps think twice before ripping up their lawn because the water they put on the lawn seeps down through the ground and waters the tree, do you agree with that?
I really don't. I think lawn should only be where it's absolutely necessary. For example, for people to use in a park where they play frisbee or a place for people to play athletics. Even that can be turned to the fake lawn, which also lets water into it.
So you think fake lawn is acceptable? I've heard from one school of thinking that fake lawn is a non-permeable barrier that doesn't let anything through, including water and insects, different species.
Absolutely part true. For example, yes, it's not good habitat. but it's good habitat for humans that want to play on it. I think it's awful because it's fake, but I also think there's a function, especially for athletic fields, where actually turf is very, very expensive to maintain.
Except, since we've got into the topic of fake lawn, there also has been rather worrisome reports about some of the fake lawns that are made of, recycled tires that are carcinogenic.
Absolutely. I think there are many products that, if you're going to make fake lawn, I like that term because that's what it is, that you would use recycled non-toxic materials. It's the same kind of part of the kit of things we need to do to make the landscape more adaptable to our lifestyle and our climate.
That's Charles Anderson, landscape architect. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Coming up after this break, Gideon Brower takes us into LA's labyrinths.
Take KCRW with you on one of our mobile apps. Available for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry devices. Stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and our News 24 and Eclectic 24 streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Mention labyrinths and you may think of medieval cathedrals, New Age mysticism, or the legend of the Minotaur in ancient Crete. You likely wouldn't think of busy urban Los Angeles. But it turns out these complicated symmetrical walking paths are all around us, serving as places for meditation or prayer or simply as decorative design elements. Gideon Brower visited a few of LA's many labyrinths and he filed this feature for DNA.
If you know where to look, LA is lousy with labyrinths. The convoluted walking paths can be found all over the city, laid out in stone, brick, tile, or concrete, or painted on canvas and rolled out for special occasions. They're at churches and at schools, hospitals, libraries, parks, and cemeteries. If you find yourself at a fancy rehab center or a quiet meditation garden, there might be one there too.
This labyrinth is, or a replica actually, of one in Chartres Cathedral in France, built around 1200.
Kevin McMillan is guest services director at Peace Awareness Labyrinth and Gardens in the West Adams neighborhood. Here, behind a mansion once owned by Hollywood choreographer Busby Berkeley, you'll find what has to be the Rolls Royce of local labyrinths.
This one is made out of Carrara marble. It's about 40 feet across. It has a path that goes from the outside and meanders around through four different quadrants. It's somewhere around 860 feet from the outside to the center of the labyrinth.
McMillan says a French stonemason installed this labyrinth about 15 years ago.
He was by himself. And for months and months, we would be out here with the, you know, and the dust.
The labyrinth is part of a larger meditation garden that's open to the public most afternoons. McMillan says some visitors walk the labyrinth as a form of worship. For others, it's more of a strolling meditation.
Some people take an hour and a half and they'll stop at every step and pray. I can be in and out in about 7 minutes. It just depends on what experience you want to have.
Labyrinths date back to ancient times, but their purpose and meaning is surprisingly murky. Even the relatively recent ones in Gothic cathedrals aren't well understood, though they may have symbolized a pilgrimage to Jerusalem or served some part in an obscure Easter ritual. Today's labyrinths are popular mostly as a way to quiet the mind, which sounds to me like it might be worth a try.
So this side is where you would step on, is that right?
Exactly, exactly. Okay. There's really no wrong way to walk it as long as you stay in your path.
Walking along the twisting path, putting one foot in front of the other, does feel like a kind of mental vacation. There are no choices to be made as you go, no options or dead ends. That's what distinguishes a labyrinth from a maze. You know that famous labyrinth in ancient Crete where they imprisoned the half-man, half-bull Minotaur? Well, if you want to get picky about it, that was a maze. In a labyrinth, one continuous path takes you into the center, then leads you back out again.
It's like a tiny journey. You start one place and you wind your way through to wherever it is you're going, and then you sort of unwind your way out and something has changed.
Tina Utrusis has to have the most convenient labyrinth set up in town.
Tell me where we are.
Okay, we're in our backyard. In front of us is a flat lawn area, and the labyrinth is built with flagstones and some stones that we've collected during summer vacations. And it has a fountain in the middle of it, which you can hear.
Utrusis says she and her husband decided to install this small labyrinth at their home in Palms after visiting the medieval-style one at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco. They put it in just before her 50th birthday.
We had a party, and we had sort of laid the paths out with cornmeal, and we had friends there, and it was quite lovely.
Utrusis says she likes the casual feel of a labyrinth that she can just mosey out and walk any time. She can do it barefoot if she wants.
And there's no pressure to be, like, spiritual, you know, or to have some great epiphany. You know, it's like, I think I'll go walk it. You know, I think I'll go walk the labyrinth.
This labyrinth is private, but it's still listed on the Worldwide Labyrinth Locator, an online registry that you can search using your address or zip code. That's where I find what could be the smallest labyrinth in the L.A. area, and definitely the most portable.
Are you Sarah?
Yes, I am. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Welcome to Pasadena.
I meet Sarah Emery Bunn in Pasadena's Arlington Garden, next to a spiral labyrinth made with river stones under a pepper tree. But that's not the labyrinth I've come to visit.
Can I see your personal labyrinth?
Yes, you can.
Would you describe it for me?
It's a black ink tattoo on my left foot. It's of a classical labyrinth, which is the same as the one we're sitting next to. So there's just a tinier version of what we're sitting in front of.
The thing I like most about Sarah's labyrinth tattoo, it's open to the public by appointment.
It's a little tricky to do with your finger because it's so small, but you can try it if you want to.
All right. Will you hold this for me?
Sure.
And just describe for me what I'm doing or what I should be doing.
Okay, so you're going to start at the entrance here,
uh-huh.
And you're just going to follow the path until you get to the center,
okay.
And then come right back out again, and I'm not going to talk to you while you do it.
I wish I could say I had a revelation while tracing the tiny labyrinth on Sarah's foot, but mostly I just felt self-conscious. Not that I said so.
Pretty cool, huh?
It was cool.
If we weren't friends before, we are now.
Wow.
The truth is, I may not be ready for the intimacy of such a personal labyrinth, but I did walk the bigger one there in the park afterwards. And the experience was pleasant and peaceful, much like at the meditation garden. The way Sarah describes her own experience starts to make more sense to me.
They're especially useful when there's something on my mind or some little problem I'm struggling with. And if I get that in mind before I start walking, some answer comes, some little hint or clue comes to help me out with whatever issue I'm struggling with. It's just nice. It's just nice to be quiet and walk it.
For DNA, I'm Gideon Brower.
You can see pictures of all the labyrinths Gideon Brower visited on the DNA blog. And if you'd like to find a labyrinth near you, there's a link to the Worldwide Labyrinth Locator there on the blog as well. That's it for today's show. DNA is produced by Caroline Chamberlain and mixed by Ray Guana. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Find more DNA on our blog at kcrw.com/DNA and follow us on our Facebook page at KCRW's Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. Thank you very much for listening.